Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimpare with the Public Policy Channel, and today I am pleased to welcome Darren Bahrainey, author of The New Welfare Consensus, Ideological, Political, and Social Origins from SUNY Press. Darren, welcome.
Thank you, Stephen, for having me.
So before we talk about the book itself, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and what it is that brought you to this particular project?
Sure. So in the mid-1990s, with the run-up to and signing of the welfare reform bill and eventually in 1996, the debate and discussion around welfare and policy and reform and all of the related issues like work and family and personal responsibility and the role of the state to provide a minimum, you know, standard of living for those at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, et cetera. You know, the discussion that was happening around that time for me, I was just starting a master's in public administration program at SEPA at Columbia. And the prevailing kind of assumptions that were being made and the kind of things that were being said in that discourse, many of them for me just didn't seem to add up. But I felt like at least I know I wasn't the only person who felt this way, but in that environment, I felt sort of, you know, out of a cohort of a few dozen people, I felt like the only person that was thinking about these things in a kind of New Deal expansionist kind of paradigm still, which at that time, I think people thought of as very passe, because all of the kind of cutting edge ideas around welfare reform were all about decentralizing the financing and administration of programs and public-private partnerships, you know, this drive toward neoliberal privatization of everything, et cetera. So I sort of, you know, I was only in my mid-20s, but I kind of felt like in terms of, you know, policy thought, I felt a bit like a dinosaur. So it got me thinking about these issues, and it got me wondering, like, where these assumptions, where these ideas came from. So I was interested to know the philosophies, the actual ideas that came to constitute these ways of thinking and what their origins were philosophically, but also what the conditions, what the environment was that sort of allowed this way of thinking about not just programs and policy, but the non-working and welfare poor, like human beings, you know, thinking about them in these really, what I viewed as very sort of problematic terms, you know, evoking some of the worst, you know, racial and ethnic stereotypes and all kinds of assumptions around traditional gender and family roles, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that's sort of what got me interested in that. After the MPA, I worked in city government for a while. I worked for the Department of Homeless Services in New York City here where I live. And I, you know, I did contract oversight, but also I worked on affordable housing development. I helped work on the adult rental assistance plan for New York City. I also contributed to numerous new need request memos to the Office of Management and Budget here in the city. This was during the Giuliani administration. And those were just one after another shot down, despite the fact that, you know, I thought I was so smart making all of these points about how, well, if we kick in money, it'll leverage money from the state and the federal government. And these permanent housing solutions that are affordable for formerly homeless people, they reduce the chances of recidivism back to the shelters and back on the streets, et cetera, et cetera. And it seemed to be falling on deaf ears. So off to a PhD program I went to sort of think about these issues related to policy and poverty and inequality, perhaps a little bit more deeply. And the New Welfare Consensus, the book, really was the sort of culmination of my dissertation research and a fairly substantial rewriting of that project.
So in trying to make sense of the state of welfare policies and looking particularly at the repeal of AFDC in the 1990s, you trace strains of you identify what you point to as three different strains of anti-welfare thought, conservative thought from the post-war period leading up to the president. If you could sort of talk to us about what each of those three strains of conservative / anti-welfare thought is, and walk us through that story. How do you think we do get from that relatively expansionist period of the 1930s to the contractions of the 1990s?
That's an excellent question. When I looked into these things, I wanted to trace those ideas, but I didn't want it to merely be a kind of intellectual history or a history of ideas, but rather a kind of consideration of those ideas in relation to the system of late capitalism, the political and economic systems, the way people have different levels of power and decision-making in terms of those systems. And so I wanted to consider those ideologies as they sort of tapped into and stoked all kinds of white patriarchal resentment, were tinged with all kinds of problematic assumptions around race and ethnicity and gender and family, et cetera, but to think about them as sort of material forces unto themselves, to kind of use Stuart Hall's terminology, by actually rooting them in the moment, in the sort of the related conditions and historical and social that kind of allowed them to gain traction and take hold. So what I did was I kind of tried to go as far back as I could to where the discussion around welfare reform and around welfare and policy in general at least kind of sounded like some of the things that are being said today in more contemporary conservative discourse around welfare. Now, it's important to note, I should say, that anti-welfareism in the United States, pretty much from the 80s on, arguably the late 70s on, was something that had accepted in a bipartisan manner. The assumptions bound up in this new welfare consensus in anti-welfareist ideology are largely accepted across both major parties, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, especially so-called center-left or centrist liberals, as well as conservatives, largely accept these premises now. However, the origins of these ideas really lie in different strains, as you say, of conservative thought. So those different strains are, if you trace them back, and there's a bit of a, I try to keep it as simple as possible in the book and not get bogged down in different terms and what they refer to specifically and whether it's right or wrong that people use them interchangeably, et cetera. But if we, the book starts with talking about laissez-faire free market ideas, right? The tradition of libertarianism, as it's called in the United States. Just my students always get a kick out of this, in terms of just how nuanced and complicated and confusing American political history is. What today we call economic conservatism used to be liberalism, right, in the classical sense. And because of a sort of period of transformation in terms of how classical liberals or laissez-faire individualists or libertarians, whatever we want to refer to them as, because of the sort of struggles that were taking place among intellectuals at that time, they were sort of smeared as conservatives, which is a label they rejected at first. people like Friedrich von Hayek and H.L. Mencken and Frank Chodorov and Albert J. Nock and Ludwig von Mises and the whole sort of cast of free market characters. But eventually, the people who were embracing those ideas, in addition to other kinds of conservative ideas in ways that were at times contradictory, but it's politically expedient, etc., they were doing so based on a certain set of presumptions around kind of free market or libertarian principles. And those are primarily that there should be an emphasis on free markets, that markets are extensions of nature and shouldn't be obstructed by things like labor unions or taxes in the welfare state or, any other kind of bureaucratic or state-based controls or regulation. They operate on the principle that property is something that's owned privately. They operate on the principle that the fundamental motivation that drives productive behavior for individuals is self-interest. So they tended to see they were also, in terms of foreign policy, the very staunch libertarians were isolationist. And that was one of the things that sort of drove libertarianism. Those who sort of stayed true to pure libertarianism drove them to the margins as the U.S. entered World War II and support for the war had increased. So this is where you had interesting reshufflings and sort of reorientations around different political, economic value commitments and ways people identified in terms of their politics. But any sort of state-based, central planning kind of solution to address the needs of the society were seen as a slippery slope into totalitarian dictatorship, like what happened in Europe in countries like Spain and Italy and Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, et cetera, et cetera. And some of the contributions of this tradition are that they offered and constructed a boogeyman out of the concept of collectivism. And collectivism was this interesting sort of catch-all term that could refer to anything from communism abroad to bureaus and the state at home, especially the welfare state. And the welfare state, the way libertarian ideas were ultimately kind of appropriated into the more contemporary conservative movement, especially in the 1950s around the formation of what's called the New Right, the idea was that, there were communists everywhere. They had infiltrated the United States. They had infiltrated the White House and bureaucrats that worked for welfare agencies. They were either duped by the communists and thinking they were doing the right thing, or they were themselves secret communists who were planted in the U.S. trying to turn us into a socialist and communist society by, working within the various social services bureaus. And interestingly, Friedrich von Hayek, he writes a book that's very important during this period called The Road to Serfdom. It's in that book that he talks about the need to advance classical liberal or libertarian ideas by reaching out to and working with conservatives of the more traditional sense. And in so doing, even though from his perspective, he was coordinating with and collaborating with people whose philosophies he didn't agree with, what would happen was people would be turned on to these sort of free market, laissez-faire, individualist, libertarian ideas, even though they were being advanced with the help of forming this coalition with more social conservative or traditionalist conservatives, again, the principles of which they did not agree with. They felt that once people got sort of this taste of this sort of liberty and freedom, et cetera, that those kind of more paternalistic authoritarian elements of more social conservatism would sort of fade away and the objectives of the libertarians would be sort of fulfilled. So, he in his book, he also says, just a little bit of state planning, even with good intentions, is again a slippery slope, not just into totalitarianism and dictatorship, but also into just miserable, impoverished, his terminology, third world type conditions with bread lines and all the rest of it, just like what we see in Soviet Russia. And for him, any sort of even half measure in that direction or compromise represented the potential to sort of descend into this kind of society that was sort of the, you know, in the libertarian imaginary, sort of the, you know, a nightmare scenario. So for them, you know, they were able to provide for people this kind of arsenal of rhetorical and ideological sort of sound bites where they could, you know, express anti-statist and anti-welfarist ideas when needed, even if it contradicted other aspects of their principles. And the libertarians also kind of lay the blueprint for the conservative think tank activism that's so common today as well, with the formation of the Mont Pelerin Society, the idea that the, you know, the way for people to advance their ideas politically is don't go into politics, but work in the arena of ideas and through the intellectuals, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the libertarians. Now, the more social traditionalist conservatives, they saw, like the libertarians, they saw inequality in the society as a natural human condition, an outgrowth of nature, but not because of unfettered, unobstructed markets, but at, you know, the, just a time-honored, better way of doing things, something that was sort of handed down via nature and depending upon the conservative thinker by God himself, right? Society was meant to have structure. It was meant to be unequal. You know, one rule for the ox and the lion, as Richard Weaver says, you know, is absurd and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there were similarities between these different camps of thinking. They were certainly anti-communist. They were absolutely opposed to the idea that bureaucrats should come in and sort of promote equality in any way through the welfare state or otherwise. And for them, you know, the modernist planners having the audacity, the depravity of messing with traditional quasi-aristocratic, time-honored, better ways of doing things was sort of deeply problematic for them. So you have this blending of these different ideas that come together in the 1950s in the form of what's called the New Right. The actual figures involved in the New Right, they refer to this way of thinking and themselves as fusionists or fusionist conservatism, which is really the, again, the emergence of the appearance of the New Right, figures like William F. Buckley Jr., the Journal of Opinion, really magazine, the periodical National Review. And it becomes this mouthpiece for anti-welfarist ideas and free market ideas, but sort of on the same pages as other intellectuals that are arguing for the U.S. to go to war with the Soviet Union and are promoting these more traditional social conservative ideas as well. So it presents sort of the prototypical version of the contemporary conservative movement, which is sort of a combination of these different strands of conservative thought that becomes sort of more respectable through the 50s and 60s. Extremist ideas are purged, like the Ayn Rand objectivist atheists and staunch libertarians that, you know, who are unwilling to sort of accept certain traditionalist or social conservative ideas, anarchists, et cetera. They're all sort of purged from the, you know, John Birchers, they're purged from conservatism, and conservatism becomes this more respectable, refined, seemingly coherent set of ideas, but below the surface, really rife with contradictions, all kinds of struggles and conflicts between figures within the movement. But nonetheless, it consolidates power and becomes much more influential.
No, one of the, I think, many fascinating tensions of that is that it seems to me the distinction is that those traditional conservatives were and arguably still are very much not libertarians, right? They are perfectly happy to use the power of the state if it is to intervene and shore up what they understand to be traditional family arrangements and sort of traditional economic allocation of power, right? And it seems that in many ways they wound up prevailing over the libertarians. Is that you think, a fair read?
I think that's right. What's interesting is, you know, libertarian thought, sort of, you know, economic rationality, if you will, becomes a kind of enlightenment or sort of scientistic or social scientific veneer, a kind of like legitimate, it takes on a kind of legitimating function for the conservative movement. So while the conservatives in the more traditional sense, as you say, with regard to preaching certain aspects of morality and imposing certain you know, ideas around how families should be structured and all of that. That doesn't sound like liberty, right? So there definitely were these contradictions, but they were able to sort of pull from this stockpile of free market ideas as they needed to give the conservative movement this kind of air of economistic and even enlightenment, legitimacy, essentially legitimated the American class structure and kind of it gave what was essentially an aristocratic philosophy, right? The conservative movement, especially its more traditionalist and social conservative tendencies, it gave it this sort of enlightenment and sort of, you know, democratic kind of veneer that it was able to use to justify the existing system of inequality that existed in the society. Hayek writes The Constitution of Liberty, and in the 1960 appearance of the book, there's an afterword that where he writes, it's a short essay that's called Why I Am Not a Conservative, you know, and hindsight's always 20/20, and he seems to have sort of regrets about, you know, and again, it's hard to underestimate how influential he was as a person that was able to bring different people together and advance this sort of conservative coalition forward and influence people to get into politics and became part of this movement. But he writes in that afterward that, you know, there are dangers now with collaborating with conservatives in the traditional sense because of their authoritarian and paternalistic tendencies. And so I think even Hayek and others in hindsight, really, you know, Murray Rothbard, also author of Enemy of the State and The Betrayal of the American Right and other books. He was one of the founders of the Cato Institute, along with Charles Koch and others. He sort of looked back as well and said, you know, the American conservative movement has become this theocratic crusade that just uses our ideas when it's convenient for them. And he really disassociated himself with conservatism later on. But yeah, I think that's an accurate assessment, absolutely.
So now let's say we've got another kind of merging. Let's talk a little bit about the neoconservatives. How does that wind up sort of bringing this set of emerging ideas into putative Democrats?
You know, the neoconservatives are interesting because they start out, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and I put him into this category in the book, he sort of starts out on the, you know, the Democratic sort of moderate left. And he's an interesting figure because depending on the day and the issue and the article, depending on the paragraph within the article, Daniel Patrick Moynihan kind of says and advocates for different things at different times, but there are certain consistencies for him. But anyway, perhaps more on him later. The 1960s is a pivotal time where the 50s was a pivotal time for the new right, the so-called new right. The neoconservatives are also represent a kind of blending together of these ideals, but they have a different history and they have a bit of a different legacy and it's different figures. There's even, some antagonism between the new right and the neoconservatives. There's one article in National Review that says to the neoconservatives, as they notice they're engaging in this critique of welfare and starting to be much more skeptical about liberal policy, initiatives, et cetera, where the title of the article is, you know, come on in, the water's fine. So they're kind of inviting them to join the conservative movement. The neoconservatives do it differently. Their work kind of reads very differently than the new right, but they are blending together essentially those same ideas. So in the 1960s, it's a time when typically we associate the period with the movements for justice and the new left and progressive reform. It's actually a very important time that kind of signals a shift to the right in the American political culture around different issues, but especially welfare policy. And this is for different reasons. So the neoconservatives, their politics sort of start on the left. They're assorted Trotskyists and liberals and sort of mild radicals and conservatives, to use Nathan Glaser's term. This group, especially the group that looks at these issues related to welfare, include folks like Irving Kristol, who Peter Steinfels, who wrote a great book in the 70s about the emerging neoconservatives. He calls Irving Kristol the sort of standard bearer of the group. Daniel Bell, Nathan Glazer, who recently passed away, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And there's other figures, too, who sort of preceded them but didn't sort of emphasize these policy issues so much. People like Lionel Trilling and Sidney Hook and a host of others. But at any rate, their work is interesting because they, you know, while the new right was attacking the welfare state relentlessly, they didn't yet inject into their critique this sort of language yet that demonized poor Black families, that emphasized sort of traditional social institutions. You know, they weren't using a rhetoric that had yet kind of inflamed reactionary patriarchal attitudes, you know, framing poor women's behavior in the context of things like, you know, norms around work and motherhood and sexuality, et cetera. That actually happens with these liberals who migrate politically from the, you know, again, from the left to the right. The Moynihan Report comes out in 1965. And he sort of signals this crisis that as we are investing in the welfare state, you know, these programs are promoting all of these terrible behaviors, especially single motherhood. He kind of reinforces this idea that welfare programs are promoting, and this is his language, a tangle of cultural pathology, right? So he's sort of getting into looking at urban working class and poor Black families. And he's the one that's sort of injecting this culture of version of the culture of poverty taken from Oscar Lewis, right, et cetera, and sort of applying it to the American scene and using it to sort of demonize welfare recipients, in particular African-American welfare recipients, especially single moms. And, you know, they're the ones that sort of initiate this aspect to the critique. And it's this, along with the sort of, by the end of the 1960s, depending upon what data you look at, but especially going into the 1970s, where there's increasing economic and social instability, there is a sort of reactionary racist response to the migration of Black folks moving north into northeastern and midwestern cities, as well as immigrants of color, especially Latinx immigrants coming into those same cities. You have an increase in sort of print and broadcast media stories. Martin Gillens, the Yale political science, does a great study on that. And I sort of reference him in the book where he talks about how during that period that, you know, media accounts of welfare that were negative, that talked about things like welfare fraud and the culture of poverty and the underclass, those were much, much more likely, especially in articles about the underclass where it was 100%, they were much more likely to feature images of Black welfare recipients. But when they were talking about programs that had much more public sympathy, things like disability insurance and Social Security, they almost always portrayed sort of images of white folks. So you had these largely negative but increase in media accounts of welfare and welfare recipients that were reproducing these stereotypes and these ideas. And, you know, it created this sort of confluence of conditions and forces, right, and processes that enabled this kind of ideology that was tapping into this nation and not so nation, you know, white fear around the movements for justice, the Black freedom and civil rights struggles, the, you know, and this applies today, I think, with the sort of return to authoritarianism under the current president, the sort of sense of, Toni Morrison wrote about this after the election in The Nation, where she talked about sort of, you know, support for quasi-racial sort of fascist ideology in many ways is spurned by senses of powerlessness and is sparked by the sense that people have, at least they perceive that the privilege that they've enjoyed through their lives is sort of in decline by virtue of the discourses around justice, et cetera, that are happening. So Nixon is tapping into this as well. And, you know, Trump during the campaign run up to the 2016 election, he kind of filched from Nixon a whole bunch of these little sound bites like law and order, he referred to the silent majority. So in the 1960s, there are these loudmouth activists and civil rights people out on the streets making all this noise. But when he talked about the silent majority back then, and when Trump talks about it now, he's speaking to white America, right? And he's sort of stoking this resentment around these changes that are taking place. And another important condition, sort of democratic, it's hard to sort of mention all of these things with the detail that's necessary in this short period of time, but also the changing American family structure at that time. You know, single motherhood wasn't just a urban black phenomenon. You know, the divorce rates and women who were having children who were never married, you know, those rates were increasing for all groups, but they were politicized in particular with a single mother, mothers of color, poor women of color. But
in some ways, what you show by bringing all of those strains together is that those ideas resonated and arguably continue to resonate precisely because they are racist and misogynist.
Exactly. I mean, we have to understand these things in terms of systems that reproduce privilege and disadvantage too. So if in fact I am disempowered as, let's say, a white working class or middle class person, but at the same time, you know, what W.E.B. Du Bois referred to as the white racial wage, if I feel like the premium that's placed on my whiteness, that value is in decline because of what's happening in the society, it's not just my racism, like that's a big part of it, but it's also that racism in connection to the sense that the premium that's been placed on my whiteness is, the value is decreasing. It creates this almost reactive, knee-jerk kind of authoritarian racism that is psychosocial. You know, it's very difficult to sort of, once that's sort of out of the box, it's hard to put it back in. And that's deeply troubling.
This is the Public Policy Channel of the New Books Network, and you've been listening to us speak with Darren Bahrainey, who is the author of a terrific new book called The New Welfare Consensus, Ideological, Political, and Social Origins from SUNY Press. Darren, in our last couple of minutes, tell us what you're working on at the moment.
So the last article I wrote and was published in Logos was an article that sort of looked at the World War II era research on authoritarianism and used that as a way to sort of make sense of the political rise of Trump and Trumpism. I encourage all the listeners to shamelessly plug my work, of course, to check that out. But one thing I've been thinking about sort of exploring further is, and it sort of touches on the discussion, the end of our discussion, is sort of how this authoritarian dimension, as it cuts across these racist and misogynistic ways of thinking, the way they relate to power dynamics and people's perceptions of a loss of power. I've been thinking about exploring that in a much more sort of elaborating that further in a much more comprehensive project, perhaps. By the way, I'm an associate professor at LaGuardia Community College at the City University of New York. And at LaGuardia, I'm one of the co-organizers of our campus's Surge chapter, Showing Up for Racial Justice. I'm in the early stages of working on a reflection piece about the work that we've been doing on the LaGuardia campus as a Surge chapter at an incredibly diverse place, but how the work that we do as a white affinity group, right, as allies to our colleagues and students and fellow faculty of color, how the work that we do is important in a diverse urban setting as much as it is in some other type of setting.
Darren Bahrainey, author of The New Welfare Consensus. Darren, thank you very much for joining us today.
Stephen, thank you so much for having me.